Welcome to the Tony Martinetti Show, our first show. I'm Tony Martinetti. I'm glad you could join us this day. We are big ideas, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. The show is for you if you're in a small nonprofit or a medium-sized nonprofit, and I'm going to leave to you to define small and medium. There is no definition for this show. We have experts who work with big nonprofits, and they're going to share with you their expertise in a big range of areas. Today, we're going to be talking about planned giving, board development, and technology for nonprofits, but that's just today. Overall, again, the show is big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. That other 95% that often gets forgotten. You know, I think consultants don't pay a lot of attention to small and medium nonprofits. There are lots of opportunities to make big money at bigger nonprofits, big major universities and hospitals and arts and cultural institutions. But what about the other 95%? That's who this show is for. So we're going to bring experts and expertise that big nonprofits enjoy to the other 95%. And our first guest is going to be Steve Imperato, who's going to talk about planned giving for small and medium nonprofits, and that's coming up after the break.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network. Are you suffering from aches and pains? Why not treat them naturally? Hi folks, I'm Giorgio Rapetti from Rapetti Wellness. Treat your aches and pains with natural methods at Rapetti Wellness in New York City. For more information, please call 212-721-8183. 212-721-8183. We look forward to hearing from you.
Are you confused by all the new gadgets that appear to be coming out almost on a daily basis? Is the new iPad for you? Should you be buying a PC or a Mac? My name is Jim Blue, and I make technology understandable. My phone number is 917-921-4518.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
Welcome back to the Tony Martinetti Show. I'm Tony Martinetti. The first guest on my first show is Steve Imperato. Steve is the principal of Future Funds, LLC, which is a nonprofit fundraising consultancy. They work in major giving, but they have an expertise really in planned giving. And we're going to talk all about what planned giving is and how nonprofits, small and medium, can be involved with nonprofits. I'm very pleased that Steve's work brings him to the studio. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here. We
talk about planned giving, planned gifts. Tell me, what are we referring to?
Planned gifts are when a person wants to provide an impact for its particular charity of interest, a donation that involves thinking about the best way of giving a gift. Where ordinarily any gift to a charity might be supportive of its immediate goals, a planned gift usually takes some thought ahead of time about the giving of what kind of asset benefits the donor most as it's helping the charity.
And we're typically talking about gifts that are in the donor's estate plan, right? Their estate or retirement plan?
It can be their estate or retirement plan. It can be, for instance, the giving of stocks and appreciated assets, which most people would not think of as being a planned gift. But those are types of assets that, if they're going to be giving, need to be thought well ahead of time about which assets are best for me to gift to a charity.
So you're distinguishing giving assets versus giving out of income from assets, right? Where someone, the income might be just a $500 check or even a $5,000 check, but you're talking about giving the asset that creates that income.
Correct. Very many people find that the thinking about a planned gift of any size really unleashes the power of their philanthropy. We can, working with donors, plan what's best for them financially, tax advantage-wise, and also accomplish their own financial goals for themselves and their families by what type of asset they give to their favorite charity.
And you've said a couple of times now, it's what's best for the donor. So I see you're focusing on the donor, you're sort of donor-centric fundraising.
Correct. Very many times when people are thinking about nonprofit philanthropy, it's what's best for the charity and to the people that the charity benefits, whether it's the Boy Scouts, a hospital, a college, whatever it might be. In planned giving, we look at what's best for the donor first. As we said earlier, the type of asset that is chosen to be given can have ripple effects on the donor's financial situation now, their financial plans for the future, their intentions for the rest of their family, for their heirs. So the simplest of gifts, no matter what size it might be, has an impact on their generosity now. So we do caution people about giving what they give and how and when they give it.
And is there any minimum or maximum size to these types of gifts, these planned gifts?
Certain types of planned giving techniques work better at specific dollar denominations. But in principle, they all work at whatever levels.
Okay, so it really depends on the type of gift.
Correct.
As you call it, the type of technique that we're talking about. Okay, and we'll get into some of those. What types of prospects, what sort of donor profile are we, should the small and medium nonprofits be looking at to identify the right people to talk about for planned giving?
One of the most basic things to keep in mind as you're looking at, as a nonprofit development officer, what you look at is that the giving of a planned gift by a donor is the ultimate in their relationship with you. So the first thing that you look at is who has been most supportive of your charity over a lot of time. Could be a number of years or even sporadically, but constantly and consistently supportive of your institution over a lot of time. And it may not have been at significant dollar levels of support. But that's the person who holds dear whatever your mission is. That person then becomes a prime prospect for you to discuss the potential for a planned gift with.
And you mentioned the ultimate gift. Sometimes it could be the donor's ultimate gift to the nonprofit. We'll just flesh that out a little. What do you mean there?
Well, a lot of, as you, the example you used earlier was in the gift of the asset that previously may have supported the annual gift. In other words, if someone is in the habit of giving you $500 a year, in planned giving, we're talking about the asset that generated for that person the $500. That's why we're talking about it being an example of their commitment to you and the strengthening of their relationship with you, because now you're talking about them giving their asset to you, which is a major step in your relationship with your donors.
And there's also a strengthening of the relationship between the donor and the nonprofit, because if this is a gift in someone's estate plan, then we're talking about including a charity in one of the most revered documents we have, our will. So right alongside children and grandchildren, there could be a bequest, if we're talking about a bequest, to a charity.
Correct. They are making you part of their family. And in principle, you are making them, the donors, part of the institution's inner family.
Yeah, that's well put. Right.
So you have to treat them as such and hold them close and get to know them on a personal level and help them in the planning of what this gift will do for you, that it accomplishes the person's philanthropic intent and provides for them the impact that you promised that this gift could mean to the people you serve in your institution.
Let's talk specifically about some of the different types of planned gifts. And the one that I used as an example, and I'd like to start with, is the the charitable bequest in someone's will. Can you just flesh that out a little bit?
Anyone can leave a gift in their will to any one or several of charities, whatever might be of particular importance to them in their lifetime. The bequest is a simple thing. You discuss it with your attorney, and it can be incorporated in your will. A will is a revocable document in that it can be changed. So if you do this and you find that over time your interests change or the mission of your favorite institution changes, you can change your will and include something of more importance to you at a later time in life.
And that ability to change your mind actually has an implication for the nonprofit and their relationship and
Correct.
The way they treat
right.
that donor after they're informed.
So many times we find that nonprofits assume that the gift left to them in the will is a done deal, and we don't have to pay as much attention to our donor as perhaps we were before the gift was made in the will, which is the wrong thing to do, obviously. As we said earlier, if they've made you in a special place in their will, as they would members of the family, you have to treat them like that for life. And hold them as close. When we talked about the ultimate gift, we were talking about the reasoning at that moment that I want to do something significant for my favorite charity, and so I'm going to put you in the will. It doesn't mean ultimate being the last gift, because what we find is that when you do have a donor who's left you in the will, they actually become more supportive than they may have been before. Especially if their will is to the gift in the will is to accomplish something of importance to them, such as starting a scholarship at a college. What we find is that now the person's annual gifts also go to that particular scholarship, and it actually strengthens their philanthropic relationship with you also.
So planned giving, helping other
types
of
giving,
other methods of giving.
Exactly.
I have seen statistics that the average charitable bequest is about $32,000 or $33,000 nationwide. Do you have a sense of what the lower range of a charitable bequest would be?
Some bequests can go from as little as $1,000 in some very small estates.
All right. But for a small or medium nonprofit, that could be sizable.
That's a sizable gift.
And that's a minimum size, $1,000. As I said, the average is around 32 or 33,000.
Sure. What you read about in the newspapers are the mega $100 million bequest, and naturally that makes the press. But very many people of average means make significant gifts in relation to their estate to small and medium-sized charities, which are significant gifts to the charity.
So the bequest is a very good vehicle for modest income donors.
Sure. As a development director in a small institution, you're probably telling people that a $1,000 gift can send so many children to camp for the summer or provide a new wheelchair for a hospital or whatever it might be. So a significant gift in the will can be, if it's significant for me at $1,000, it does provide an impact.
Let's talk about marketing, promoting the idea of the charitable bequest, because I do see it as sort of a way for nonprofits that are smaller to get into planned giving. How would, what are some ideas, some ways, without spending a lot of money, that our audience can promote the idea of giving to them in the donor's will?
One of the most significant ways is just in the creation of awareness that you are able to accept gifts of that nature, especially in bequests, because they are the simplest of planned giving techniques. Most people understand what a will and a bequest gift and a will does. And also, it's easier to promote just by putting a line on your website, including a PS in your normal fundraising letters, spreading the news verbally that you do accept these types of gifts. Another very important way is to acknowledge the bequest gifts that you do have.
And how would you do that?
Well, very many times when we find a charity trying to start a program, one of the first things we will suggest is the creation of a bequest society where you gather together the people who have named you in their will and acknowledge them now while they're alive and can enjoy the acknowledgement. And also, that starts to be self-generative in that other people see how you are acknowledging people who have left you in the will. And all of a sudden now, well, I had always thought I might want to do that. And let me join this group of people who are treated so nicely and have such a visual and visible investment in this institution. And I'm going to let them know I have already put them in my will, or I will add them to my will when I next speak to my attorney.
So recognizing the donors that have already done it as a means of encouraging others to do it. Also, you suggested newsletter, website, whatever print materials you have. What about the face-to-face conversation? What in just the minute that we have left, what tips would you give for the face-to-face, would you include us in your estate plan conversation?
I would always look to the person if they were at the level of relationship with you where you were discussing with them a major impact gift of some kind. Always throw out the opportunity, well, you can supplement what we're talking about in cash over now by including a gift in your will that would cement this program, this project, this part of the institution that you were supporting.
Supplement and not replace
Correct.
Your other giving.
Correct.
You're listening to The Tony Martinetti Show. I'm Tony Martinetti. My guest has been Steve Imparato. Steve is the principal of Future Funds, LLC. You'll find them on www.futurefundsllc.com. And Steve, I want to thank you very much for being the
Tony, my pleasure.
First guest on my first show. Thank you for coming in.
Bye now.
You're listening to The Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Is your marriage in trouble? Are you considering divorce? Hello, I'm Lawrence Bloom, a family law attorney in New York and New Jersey. No one is happier than the day their divorce is final. My firm can help you. We take the nasty out of the divorce process and make people happy. Please call us at 212-964-3502 for a free consultation. That's Lawrence H. Bloom at 212-964-3502. We make people happy.
This is Jim Blue. When is the last time your computer had a checkup? You probably make sure your car keeps up with its maintenance schedule. Surely most of you have annual physicals. The same should be true of your equipment. Why shorten the life of your computer? You can save money by extending the life of your equipment with a maintenance program. In order to find out what type of program works best for you, give us a call. The phone number is 917-921-4518.
TalkingAlternative.com.
This is the Tony Martinetti Show. I'm Tony Martinetti. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'd like to spend a few minutes on something that is dear to me, so dear that I wrote a book about state charity registration compliance. And I speak and write a lot about it. I want to spend a couple minutes explaining what it is, and I have a few true-false questions. These are the laws that all nonprofits, regardless of size, regardless of mission, have to comply with before they solicit charitable gifts anywhere in the country. So every state and the District of Columbia, so we're talking about 51 different sets of laws, has codified a set of laws that charities have to comply with and register under with state authorities before you are soliciting a gift in a state. So you might be a Connecticut-based nonprofit, but if you're soliciting in New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and Pennsylvania, you need to be registered not only in Connecticut, where you're probably soliciting donations, but also in all those other states. You either register or you are exempt. So the question becomes, what is a solicitation? Where are we soliciting? That's how we decide where we need to register. And that triggers my first true-false question. True or false, a website, a donate now button on your website triggers the registration requirement. That is true in a lot of states and false in some states. So if you said true, you were right. If you said false, you were right. Depends what state you had in mind when you answered. In a lot of states, having that donate now button live on your website where people can make a gift on your website triggers the solicitation requirements. And that includes states like New York and Florida and New Jersey. So once that donate now button goes live, you're soliciting in a lot of states. It's roughly about 22 states, so I just named a couple of them. But you need to be aware that that donate now button has serious implications for your legal compliance in a lot of different states. True or false, a supporting organization that you get money from registers as soliciting donations, and that covers your requirement to register for solicitations. True or false? Again, you're right if you said true, and you're right if you said false. It depends on which state you're talking about. You do need to be aware, though, that in a lot of states, a supporting organization like a community foundation that makes direct gifts to your organization, registering themselves doesn't, in a lot of states, satisfy your requirement to register under these charity solicitation laws. In other states, that is sufficient. So, you know, as you can see, the morass comes because we're dealing with 51 different sets of laws, and so my answers tend to be, it depends on which state you're talking about. I have another true-false. Email triggers your requirement to register. And again, it depends on the state. There are a lot of states where sending an email, which is a charity solicitation, request for a donation, is a solicitation and triggers the registration requirement. And there are a good number of states where that's not the case. Texas happens to be an example. Texas actually is the second most populous state. That was a surprise to me. So there are a lot of people in Texas and a lot of charitable solicitations going on in Texas. Again, doesn't matter where your charity is based, but if you're dropping email into Texas, you're actually safe. Texas considers email to be an exception. Now, if you're dropping paper mail, U.S. mail, into Texas, that is a solicitation. But unlike Texas, the email standing alone that solicits a donation is triggering the registration requirement. And not surprisingly, a lot of the states that I mentioned that consider a website triggering the requirement also consider email triggering the requirement. So also those states, California, New York, New Jersey, and Florida also considers email to be a charity solicitation and triggers your registration requirement. If you'd like more information about charity registration, I did write a book, and it's a book that will explain what all the requirements are in all the 50 states and DC too, so all 51 states and jurisdictions. It is charity registration, state-by-state guidelines for compliance, and you'll find that at statecharityregistration.com. My next guest is Scott Kegler. Scott is on the line, and he is the editor of Nonprofit Technology News. I'm very glad that Scott's able to join us. Scott, how are you? Welcome.
I'm good, Tony. Thanks.
Thank you very much for joining us. I'm glad your work brings you to the show. Thank you very much.
Great. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks. We want to spend some time talking about something that I think is going to be of terrific interest to our audience, small and medium-sized nonprofits. The idea of on-demand software or software as a service and how that can help a lot of small nonprofits in critical functions. Can you help us understand what that is?
Sure, Tony. Just to start out with kind of a definition and a differentiation, most of us have been used to installing software on computers or servers within inside the firewall. In other words, inside the office. And that was very, very popular. In fact, pretty much the only way to do things. And it was not uncommon because a lot of people worked in the office. And a couple things have changed. One is not all of us work in the office anymore. A lot of us work remotely on an internet connection. And so being able to get to the software that's in the office had become a burden. Kind of concurrent with that, technology changed and moved to the point where remote computing services, now called SaaS, software as a service, and also increasingly being called clouding, are available at pretty nominal fees. You can rent essentially a server and disk space that live God knows where in the cloud and put your applications on there and offer those for use by multiple companies. So software as a service essentially means that you're renting software on a service basis. And so it's really a good name for it.
And we're going to talk shortly about fees and get into that because I know it's very cost efficient for smaller organizations. So we're talking about SaaS, and that's I want people to understand that's typically written capital S, lowercase a, capital S, SaaS.
Exactly.
Software as a service. When I was learning computing in college, I used something also called SaaS, but that was SAS, statistical analysis software, I think, SaaS.
Right.
This is very different.
Yes.
What are some of the things that this cloud computing, this software as a service can do for nonprofits? What types of functions can it help with?
I'm going to go through just a short list here of a few features that are pretty commonplace. And actually, I'm reading this list off of Adaptive Planning's website. They did a nice job. Adaptive Planning is one of those companies that offers a SaaS-based application for nonprofits.
Scott, would you just give us that the URL for that quickly?
Sure. It's www.adaptiveplanning.com.
Thanks.
So what they identify as the main, advantages of SaaS, and I would concur with these through other work that I've done, lower cost. Basically, you don't have to buy the application. So you are renting it, typically on a month-by-month basis, and also typically there's no long-term commitment. So rather than buying an application for $500, $10,000, $50,000, and installing it inside your office, basically you say, I'm going to rent this stuff for a month, I'm going to try it out, if I like it, I'll continue for the next month, and if I don't, I have no further commitment.
So there isn't
a lower cost.
So there isn't a high startup cost, which is, as you said, which is typical for a lot of the office-based software programs.
Absolutely. You don't have to buy a server. You don't have to buy software. The only requirement you really have is a decent internet connection. And decent can go all over the place. A good dial-up connection can provide a decent connection to a SaaS application.
Excellent.
Not necessarily need a DSL or a cable modem kind of connection. So it makes it very flexible and easy to get to.
Okay, so the only barrier to entry is one that's really not much of a barrier because every office is going to have a decent internet connection.
Right, and most homes.
Yeah, so right.
Which
so
is
if it's
the,
smaller,
the opposite side of that.
For a small organization in a home.
You have distributed volunteers working. You just have people all over the place, and they just want to put in an hour or 10 minutes or 5 hours worth of work. They don't need to get to the office. They just log in, take care of their work, and log off.
Now, what are some of the modules, then, that can be used to help specific functions?
They pretty much go all across the board for every kind of application that a nonprofit would want, everywhere from constituent management to fundraising to event management. Everything that you could think of that you would deploy inside the office is available in some form, in some SaaS module provided by some company.
My guest is...
And that's not to say that they're all the same. You know, Tony, they're diverse.
Excellent. Well, that has greater benefit for our audience, the small and medium nonprofits. My guest is Scott Correct. Kegler. Scott is the editor of Nonprofit Technology News. You'll find the company website at www.nptechnews.com, and Scott is the editor at that site. What about financial modules, Scott? Are there finance and accounting modules available too?
There are. And I'm just looking at, I'm going to give you three examples, actually four examples. And one of them, well, let's just start with the one I just talked about, adaptive planning. And that really gives you a wide range of applications. Let's see if I can just look at the functions that they've put together here.
And you mentioned some events, fundraising,
right,
constituent management.
Adaptive planning has budget and forecasting, reporting, administration. They have something called private team collaboration. So if you have subsets of volunteers or employees that want to work together, they can kind of section off their own section of a conversation. So that pretty much runs the gamut of the kinds of features and functions that you want.
So there's donor management. There can be volunteer management, the module you just described, and there's also the accounting and finance, sort of what we typically call the back office. All these functions are available in this on-demand software.
Right, and they are all interconnected, so you don't have to be worried about copying information from one application to another. And that's pretty common among SaaS applications in general, because you have one set of data that is shared by not just the application and not just the users, but also the application database is shared by every set of users that's in there. And I just probably just give you 1 second here about that, because a lot of people think about SaaS and shared data or shared structure as a security risk. So, if I'm running an organization and you're running an organization and we're putting our constituent data into that application, they actually reside in the same server. The implication there is that, I can get to yours and you can get to mine. And, of course, that's absolutely programmed out of the equation. There's so much activity in the SaaS world today that security is among the top issues that these folks that are providing SaaS applications have.
And it's going to be a top concern for nonprofits. I mean, look
absolutely.
At it. If they're using a fundraising module, for instance, now all their donor data is in the cloud. I mean, that's credit card numbers, addresses, conceivably social security numbers, dates of birth. This is the most critical, most precious information that a charity has, charity of any size. So you're saying security is a significant concern for the companies. I mean, they're recognizing what charities are trusting them with.
Sure, and just to expand that a bit, these companies deal with credit card and personal information for applications as sensitive as medical applications. And of course, there are, aside from just being private information, there's some pretty legal stipulations with HIPAA and those kind of things. So the benefit there is that if these SaaS companies are providing application services for environments that are very, very strictly legally regulated, then that trickles down to even my application, my personal stuff that's out there on the cloud. So if they can be trusted with those kind of things, they probably can be trusted with my word processing documents.
Okay, so but
that's the good part about this.
The organization wants to know what the company's commitment is to security, and as you're saying, the company offering this kind of software might already have a history of high security based on other applications that they're offering to, outside the nonprofit community.
Correct, and it's always you know, the burden is still on the user. I mean, if I installed an application in my nonprofit, I would be looking at the security that I was enabling around people just getting into my server. So it doesn't really take away my responsibility, but it does give me a little bit of leverage in that security is not my primary business, but it is top of mind for these people that are providing SaaS-based services.
That's I think that should be reassuring. And as I said, it's something the nonprofit's going to want to investigate. Scott, these all sound scalable, so that you can start with one or two modules. Again, we're thinking about small and medium nonprofits. They can start with maybe just one or two modules, maybe in events and fundraising, and then scale up if they have additional needs or not, right?
Absolutely. That's one of the beautiful parts of this, is that it's easy to, in fact, it's almost a non-issue to sign up for service with one or any of these companies. Typically, you go to the site, you create a login, just as you would on Facebook. And you think about Facebook. You go there, you log in, you find out what it's all about, and if you like it, you use it, and if you don't like it, you go away. And it's pretty much the same with any kind of SaaS-based application.
And you had said earlier, month-to-month commitments.
Right, month-to-month. Some of them will allow you a 30-day free trial, kind of to get things together, to get some of your data online. And, of course, they assume that once you get your data online, you're probably less likely to go away. But still, it gives you the opportunity at no risk.
There are reviews of different SaaS products on the website at www.nptechnews.com. And my guest has been the editor of Nonprofit Technology News, Scott Kegler. Scott, thank you again for joining me.
Sure, Tony. Thanks a lot for having me.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network. Are you suffering from aches and pains? Why not treat them naturally? Hi folks, I'm Giorgio Rapetti from Rapetti Wellness. Treat your aches and pains with natural methods at Rapetti Wellness in New York City. For more information, please call 212-721-8183. 212-721-8183. We look forward to hearing from you.
Are you confused by all the new gadgets that appear to be coming out almost on a daily basis? Is the new iPad for you? Should you be buying a PC or a Mac? My name is Jim Blue, and I make technology understandable. My phone number is 917-921-4518.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com. Talking Alternative.
This is the Tony Martinetti Show, and I'm your host, Tony Martinetti. My guest right now is Michael Davidson. Michael is a board coach, works significantly in board development. We're going to flesh out exactly what board development is. You'll find Michael at www.michaeldavidson.biz. And I'm very glad that your work brings you to the studio. Welcome, Michael.
Welcome. Good morning, Tony. Right.
Let's talk a little about board development. That phrase is very common. Let's dive into it a little bit. What activities are involved in your work in board development?
Well, there's a number of pieces to it. And the key to the question is really, what is it that the organization needs of its board? And the answer to that is going to be very varied. I mean, there are some large organizations in which their boards are largely fundraising boards, in which they're really focusing on bringing in significant amounts of money. There may be a smaller group dealing with the governance of the organization. And so in an organization like that, the work with the board has to do with skills in fundraising, recruiting people with fundraising skills, and like that. On the complete other end of the spectrum, I work a lot with very small organizations, usually startup organizations. There's a founder, there's a few people really interested in the particular issue that they're concerned with, the service that they're offering, and things like that. And in the beginning, there may be minimal staff or even no staff, just a couple of volunteers who are really concerned about a particular issue in society. And on that level, the board is really much more of a volunteer board. While they do have fundraising and fiduciary responsibilities, they're also very much volunteers. They're helping out with everything that would otherwise be done for a staff. And so depending upon the nature of the particular needs that the organization has, the kind of work that you do with development with the board is very different. So, for example, in a small organization, I would really spend a lot of time on figuring out exactly what it is that the board needs to do. What are the board roles? And sometimes which hats the boards are wearing. Because even in a small situation, the board is going to be wearing, in a sense, multiple hats. While it may also have a volunteer role, it also has a fiduciary role. So, for example, you may have one of the volunteers actually functioning as a bookkeeper, for example, and working with the chief volunteer, who is the founder, on keeping the books and managing the money. But at the same time, there needs to be a board finance committee that's providing some oversight to that function. So board members have to kind of like flip hats back and forth and understand exactly what the roles are. So in that kind of organization, you're really focusing on clarifying the roles, clarifying what's board, clarifying what's management, and those kinds of questions.
And I find in a lot of organizations, these roles are not defined. So board members really don't know what the expectations are of them, whether it's fundraising. In a lot of cases, they may not understand their fiduciary legal obligations to the organization. These roles are often not so well explained when someone joins a board.
Yeah, I think that it's a problem. But there really are very simple and direct solutions. I mean, there are documents available, publicly available, which explain the basic fiduciary duties of a board. In New York State, for example, there's a pamphlet that's published by the Attorney General called Right from the Start, which explains the essential fiduciary duties. There's Board Source in Washington, D.C., which has basic pamphlets on fiduciary duties. But once you get past that, there really needs to be a conversation that you have with the board members around very specific expectations.
And we're going to talk about those conversations after the break. My guest is Michael Davidson, professional board coach. You'll find him at www.michaeldavidson.biz. And Michael will join us after the break.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Is your marriage in trouble? Are you considering divorce? Hello, I'm Lawrence Bloom, a family law attorney in New York and New Jersey. No one is happier than the day their divorce is final. My firm can help you. We take the nasty out of the divorce process and make people happy. Please call us at 212-964-3502 for a free consultation. That's Lawrence H. Bloom at 212-964-3502. We make people happy.
This is Jim Blue. When is the last time your computer had a checkup? You probably make sure your car keeps up with its maintenance schedule. Surely most of you have annual physicals. The same should be true of your equipment. Why shorten the life of your computer? You can save money by extending the life of your equipment with a maintenance program. In order to find out what type of program works best for you, give us a call. The phone number is 917-921-4518.
TalkingAlternative.com.
Welcome back. I'm Tony Martinetti. My guest is Michael Davidson, board coach. And we're going to talk about some of these difficult conversations around what can be difficult relationships. I mean, a board is essential to every nonprofit. You can't incorporate as a nonprofit without identifying who your board is. But how do you deal with your board? That's Michael's expertise. Michael, let's talk a little about recruiting, and then we'll get into retaining board members. But in terms of recruiting, what would we look for board? What makes an ideal board member?
There's no simple answer. One of the things that you really have to start with in the recruiting process is figuring out really what it is that the organization needs. And different organizations are going to need different kinds of skills. And so the kinds of people that you're looking for really get determined by the analysis of what it is that the work needs to be done. But after that, you're looking for people that, two things, it seems to me. Number one, really care about the mission of this organization. This is personally important to them. And what's personally important to you, Tony, and what's personally important to me, really very different things. And not everybody cares about the same things, but you really have to start out with people who really care about this particular function. But then, then you need people with the right kinds of skills and representations that bring the information and expertise that you need onto the board. But after that, I think what you're really looking for, and lots of organizations kind of forget about this, is you're really looking for people who really know how to play well with others. I mean, because boards are essentially social groups, and they either work as a social group or they don't work as a social group. And people are either comfortable with group decision-making, or they're the kinds of people that are lone rangers and are always used to making their own decisions and telling everybody what to do. And I'm always looking, when I'm helping people do recruitment, for people that know how to play well together.
And how can we assess that? It sounds like a critical skill, because it is a group, as you said, it's a social group. How can we assess who the good people are who can play right?
It's really not difficult, you know? You ask the questions. You know, one of the questions I'd want to ask is, you know, tell me about how you work in your professional life, right? Have you ever worked in teams with other people? What's been the experience of that? Have you ever worked on a team with people ever in your life? And what's been your experience? The person that tells me, you know, Mike, I've never done that before. I've never worked collaboratively with anybody else. To me, that's a real red flag. Because if somebody has never worked collaboratively, excuse my English this morning.
Oh, you have a great voice for radio. It's okay.
I'm not sure that they ever wanted to work collaboratively with anybody else. And then, so once they do give me an example that they have, then I'll explore it. What's it been like? What worked? What didn't work? What did you like about it? What didn't you like about it? And those kinds of things, I think, are really important. And then you get into all of the other kinds of things about what the particular expectations are. I just want to just alert your audience to a tool that you can use for a lot of these things I'm talking
Please.
About. And it's on my website. It's totally free. You can download it. And I've created something from the resources section, and I've created something called the Board Tune-Up Kit. And it really has tools that you can use for almost all of the kinds of issues for board development. For example, it's got a sample set of expectations. And then you can have a discussion with the board, which of those expectations people want to have. It's got tools for recruitment, all of that kind of stuff. Again, it's a Word document. You're free to download it, use it the way you want it.
People will find that toolkit at michaeldavidson.biz. That's recruiting. Let's talk about keeping the good board members, retaining the talent that we've successfully recruited. What ideas do you have?
It's really interesting. You know, people worry. They say, oh, my God, I'm going to get these people on the board, and I don't want to give them too much work to do, because if I give them too much work to do, they're going to leave me. They're not going to want to stay, right? And actually, the contrary is what's true. The more work you give people on a board, the more clear work you give them, the happier they are.
Because they love what you're doing.
That's right.
That was part of the recruitment.
Exactly right. If they didn't care about this thing, they wouldn't be there. They want to be there because they want to contribute. They want to make a difference in this thing. And you've really got to find ways to organize the work, make sure everybody's got meaningful work. And that's not, you know, and I'm really underlying meaningful work. And so sometimes that requires a balance with the executive directors, who sometimes are a little jealous about what's under their control. And they have to be willing to let up a little bit of control in order to give people really meaningful responsibility in the board. But they've really got to be engaged. And the board meetings have got to be interesting. You've got to do things at the board meeting that are not boring. One of the things that happens at a lot of board meetings is, yeah, I'm sure you've all been at them. Yeah, get to the board meeting, and then everybody is reading the reports of their committees, right? And while everybody's reading the reports of their committee, you know exactly what's happening. People are either dozing off, right? If they're on the phone, you can hear some little click, click, so they're working on their computer while that's happening. If they're in the room, they're working on their BlackBerries under the table. Nobody's in tension, right? So what good boards do now is all that routine stuff, they just mail it out. And say, we're not going to talk about any of this.
It's done in advance of the meeting.
Done in advance. If it doesn't have to be talked about, we're not going to talk about it. If it's just for information. Then what you do with the board meeting is you really make it interesting. You talk about subjects that don't have solutions. You brainstorm new problems that the organization is facing. You bring in clients to talk about interesting things that have happened to them as a result of the wonderful work that this organization has done.
Oh, so bring in people who have benefited from the organization's work to a board meeting.
Absolutely.
And make that part of a board agenda?
Absolutely. The board members are there because they care about this work. And if they're not being connected through the board meeting with the work, it's boring. It's not interesting to them. You bring in outside speakers that have things to say about the subject matter in which you're working, right? So your youth development organization. There are lots of things that lots of other organizations are doing in youth development that may not necessarily be competitors to you. Bring them in. Learn from them. Talk to them. Experts in the field, things like that. You want the board meeting to be fun. It's got to be some place that you want to come to and say, you know, I can't wait for the next board meeting because it really was interesting this time.
You're creating a model of a board meeting that I've never been to, but you're trying to keep board members engaged, interested, active.
It's the currency. Remember, you know, we ask an enormous amount of board members. We ask them to come to meetings. We ask them to contribute money. We ask them to ask their friends for money. We ask them to use their resources, their intelligence. What are we giving them back? We've got to give them back a commensurate amount for the great gifts that they're bringing. And part of that commensurate amount is really an engaging board meeting, connection with the organization, and interesting work to do. It's a trade-off, right? You don't keep good board members unless you give them the reason they want to be there.
Outstanding. That's really interesting, I think valuable information. And again, not a model of board engagement that I see very much. And you're describing a board meeting that I've never been to. But
well, hopefully you'll be that way. Yeah. The next board you join.
Let's shift to a board relationship where a member or two, it's not working out well. Should there be policies about that? What do you do where you recruited the right person, you did everything you could to engage and interest them, but the relationship is just not working?
Right. You do a couple of things. Number one, you really have to have clear expectations. There really need to be written expectations for board members, even to the point of saying everybody's expected to participate and support other people in the conversation and to read and prepare for board meetings in advance. Things that basic, right? So then you get somebody who's not doing it. So what do you do, right? You could do a couple of things. First of all, many boards now do yearly assessments in which they review that. But another thing is you get somebody who's a bad actor, who's not doing this stuff. The chair of the board calls them in, sits down, and says, look, these are the expectations we've agreed to. You're not living up to these expectations. I think you need to resign. The chairman has to say that. The person says, oh, no, I don't want to resign, blah, 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 blah. Then you have a recourse. The board can vote them off. And that's the way that usually once the chair has that conversation around expectations, then you don't even need to do the vote.
Michael, thank you very much. Excellent advice about recruiting, retaining, engaging, keeping board members interested, and if the relationship isn't working, how to professionally manage the board members' departure. My guest has been Michael Davidson, absolutely professional board coach. You'll find him at www.michaeldavidson.biz. Michael, I want to thank you very much for joining me, and I want you back.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's been a fun conversation.
I'll be back after right now. I'm continuing, and there isn't a break. We are coming to the end.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
I really need to take better care of myself. If only I had someone to help me with my lifestyle. I feel like giving up.
Is this you? Mind over matter, health and fitness can help. If you're expecting an epiphany, chances are it's not happening. Mind over matter, health and fitness can help you get back on track or start a new life in fitness. Join Joshua Margolis, fitness expert, at 212-865-9290 or visit www.mindovermatternyc.com.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com. Talking Alternative.